This is Game On. With your host, Seat Williams.
Game On!
Time to get lit. 3 o'clock, standing tall, feeling good. Hump day as we move through the weekday. Feeling good here, folks. Seat Williams, Ari back in the wheels of steel. Plenty to get to today, a loaded show. A couple of recaps we'll assume as far as the local teams putting up W's. Dope at the bottom of the hour. That final go-around, we're going to give away a pair of Rebel tickets. Rebs, Mississippi Valley State comes to town, and that's December 20th. We'll give those away in that final go-around. Andy Isco of Logical Approach, he's about 9 minutes or so away. We'll kind of look at a very intriguing, nice slab of games in Week 14 in the NFL. And there's about maybe nine games, maybe eight or nine games with playoff implications in them. So we'll jump on those as well. Well, the Rebels got busy. They continue to put up W's. A couple of tough overtime losses. They had the, a triple overtime loss at Northern Iowa. And then the overtime loss, was it 91-88, I believe, against Arizona. And last night they had no problems with Oral Roberts. They beat them down by the final score of 92-66. Check out McCoy. He gets it done, and then, of course, we'll close it out.
Quickly up ahead, left side, Hardy to McCoy for the slam dunk. Right. Brandon finally working out some frustration. Hardy back to Beck. Pass underneath to Mbake. Whoa. Slam dunk. Wow.
There's the Sandman along with Robert Smith getting it done as the Rebels win 92-66. Overall, Roberts keep putting the W's up. The seven-footer just doing his thing. Also, across the strip, the G-Knights, another victory in a shootout. It was Alex Tuck getting it done, then the save.
Tuck the righty, comes through the right circle, forehand, backhand. He scores! Alex Tuck! Woo! In the third round, he roofs it on the backhand. First shootout goal. Kasha 0-for-1 this year. The righty goes down the middle. Forehand. Stopped by Subban! Vegas wins it! A double fist pump from Subban! Golden Knights prevail in the shootout. 4-3, the final.
Hockey is very exciting. To me, the most exciting part of hockey is the 3-on-3 overtime and the shootout. Soccer, the same way. The most exciting part of soccer to me is when they have the shootout. Certain sports, and soccer, it's a growing sport. It is the most popular sport in the world, as opposed to here, other than here in the United States. Football rocks this country. But in soccer, when they have their shootout, I'm sorry, man. Like, the cup coming up, we're not in it. Who was it, Brazil or someone else pretty big, didn't quite make it. But I'll be watching, and I'm looking for the shootout. Hockey, as exciting as hockey to be, when they go into overtime and it's three guys on the ice going against three guys, that is exciting sports right there. And then the shootout, can't top it. So the G-Knights get the victory. You were there, right? What kind of crowd?
Yeah, oh, great crowd, as always. after the post game, not so much because it's so cold outside. But, yeah, it was great energy on both sides as usual.
Now, it's cold outside. How cold is it inside?
It's cold. Not quite as bad as outside now. If you asked me about a month and a half ago, it was colder inside than outside. But now it's just cool inside.
What do you wear? Because you're working all the games.
I wore, and I still didn't work out. I wore a wife beater, a long sleeve shirt, a t-shirt over that, and my this thing that I have. It's like almost like a jacket. It's really warm, heavily insulated. That thing is like never fails me ever to keep me warm.
Didn't work last night.
It was all right for a while, and then towards the end, I mean, we're out there till the post game goes till close to 1 a.m. To midnight by the time it's well, the game ends. What is it?
So you get
10.
There what time?
I get there about 4:35. We start our pregame is 6:30 to 7. Then we do intermissions. So basically, the game is about 3 hours, give or take. If it ends at 10, and last night was overtime, so I'm even a little later, and then it's an hour and a half post-game show. So by the time we wrap up, it's 11:30, almost midnight.
An hour and a half post-game show.
90 minutes, yeah.
That's longer than any other sport. I mean, NFL doesn't do it. NBA.
I don't think that's baseball. Conventional.
That's not normal.
Yeah, we go to great lengths. So.
Well, good. I'm quite cool, sure it's very entertaining.
Great energy, yeah. It's a lot of fun, honestly. I need to catch a game just in relaxed mode and not be working, but I work them all, so I don't know. We'll see.
You're starting to learn the sport more.
I am, though, yeah. Without even trying, it's just you hear these names over and over and over. Alex Tuck, I'm well familiar with this guy. Literally, I know everything about the guy. He's a super nice guy in the community and all these different things. A real team player. I've heard so much. I'm just surrounded by it all the time, so I'm picking up, trying to.
Now, you were there 2 practices ago, or were you, when the one player, they taped this fake
I wasn't
scrotum
there.
And penis on his helmet?
Yeah, I wasn't there, but I saw the picture. So, yeah, it's pretty funny. They're funny guys. And I think it's interesting because the way you put it together, you're just throwing a bunch of guys together, essentially. Obviously, they have the same goal to win and everything, but, you know, you to get this kind of chemistry, and that's why I think they're winning. This is not a hockey expert opinion. It's just kind of common sense almost. I think they have a really cool energy and good chemistry within the actual organization and the team. We hear a lot of like interviews and stuff. They're really playful, they're fun, they're having fun, and they don't really seem to have any angst. You know how there's little conflicts in these teams sometimes, you know, about this guy doesn't like this guy. Doesn't seem to be the case. They seem to really be all focused on the same thing, so it's pretty cool.
So you kind of have a camaraderie, you're saying?
Yeah, amongst the players, yeah, definitely, and the organization too. So good to see. So I think that equates to some winning, definitely. We'll see. We're about a quarter of the way through the season. Can't really talk about the playoffs yet, but I don't know. If it continues at this pace, the way they're winning, definitely, and the way they're playing. And the key, too, one more thing I learned, is that the whole goalie situation, as you've probably heard, they're like 4 deep. Subban just came back recently. The starter, Marc-Andre Fleury, he has been out since I think it was like the 2nd or 3rd game. He's been out for a while, and they've been able to win without him and like 4 other goaltenders. So, you know, they're not even at their best right now. So, yeah, you know, without jinxing anything, it's looking pretty good. We'll see. See how it goes.
That's your update. Hockey
there you
guru. Already in the box.
Apparently.
You know, let's talk a little bit about what's going on in California with the fires. There's 4 different fires going on, and it was so bad, or it's been so bad, that the 405 is one of the busiest freeways in the entire country. It was shut down. I believe parts of it was reopened today is what I'm hearing in reports. Now, the fire is so fierce. UCLA, their game tonight against Montana has been postponed. There's no way they're going to risk it. It's a little too close to Poly Pavilion. So that game is off the calendar. And also off the calendar, The Rams, they had to cancel their practice today because of the fires. Every year, we run into this because of the Santa Ana winds. A fire will start up somewhere in a brush, and before you know it, the Santa Ana winds will hit in there. You felt the winds 2 days ago. What's it like when we have 45-mile-an-hour winds? Well, kicking up in a forest, it could be 60 miles an hour, and you got fighter fires. No one's been killed. I saw a feature where they were gathering some horses. A camera crew was out there for one of the outlets, and he puts down his camera. They saved all these horses. And I recall back when the Chargers were in San Diego, back when LaDainian Tomlinson was playing, his house got destroyed. So Southern California, up in the L.A. area, it's more common. Every year it takes place. And you had a woman who moved from Napa Valley up north in NoCal to SoCal, and she was only in her new home for less than 4 months. Her home got burned down. So it's very unfortunate. So the firefighters are doing their best. They got firefighters from all over the country, and they're fighting. It's sad. I mean, the disasters we have with the floods, the hurricanes, and now the fires in California. And it lends you to take a moment and realize how fortunate we are in the valley. Okay, we had the fires up on Mount Charleston, but we've never really had a major natural disaster in Vegas, have we? I can't think of anything. So we had the knucklehead do the shooting, but October 1, but that wasn't a natural disaster. We just haven't had them. So we're very blessed to be in a part of the country where I think we can be okay in that sense. This guy's always okay. He's got his act together. Logical approach man, Andy Esco. Andy, how are you today?
Seat, I'm doing well. Hopefully you are as well.
You know, yes, I am. I had to give you some additional props on the air after we had you on last week because you hit it out the park. And I haven't heard anyone else say this, Andy, but you're right. The committee for college football, it is not a playoff. It is an invitational. You hit it out the head. I haven't heard anyone else use that term, Andy, but you're absolutely correct. They invite who they want to invite. It isn't about who beat whom. It isn't about a conference championship. It's about who they want in the tournament, and they know that Alabama's fans are going to travel. Okay, if Wisconsin had won, they know that Wisconsin has a good following base. It's about money, and it's about who the committee prefers in over someone else.
I'm not really sure what the reluctance is to expand the playoff, but consider the fact that only four teams out of 130 get quote-unquote invited to participate in determining a national champion. That's about 3%. Compare that to the NCAA basketball tournament that involves 68 teams out of roughly 351. That's almost 20%. That's a little bit more meaningful as far as giving teams opportunities, but part of my real problem is that if you've got five major power conferences, you automatically need to include all five conference champions, whether you determine them in a championship game, if you determine them by a vote of the school presidents or athletic directors, however you determine it. For example, this year with two SEC teams in there, for the Big Ten and the Pac-12, not to have a representative play for what is supposedly a national title just seems wrong on the surface. Now, as far as Ohio State and Alabama goes, as far as that controversy, both teams have flaws. I can make a better case for Alabama being in because I can make a case for Ohio State being left out. Now, the committee is supposed to determine the, quote, four best college football teams, okay, end quote. Now, that's a subjective decision, but I cannot find any reason to believe that if you are considered to be amongst or near the top four best teams, that you have any excuse for losing a game by 31 points, as Ohio State did on the road to Iowa. If you're amongst the best teams in the nation and your offense isn't playing well one game, your defense picks up the slack. If you're one of the best teams in America and your defense isn't playing well one game, your offense picks up the slack. The only excuse for Ohio State to lose and not be downgraded for a loss by 31 points is if that loss came to the New England Patriots.
Okay, I'm not going to disagree with you there. Now, help me with a solution here. Now, you say the Pac-12 and also the Big Ten were left out this year. What's a perfect number for you? Because my opinion is I like four, but I'll accept six. Are you going deeper than six or kind of give us your setup? You got five in. Let's say each conference has a champion. The five are in. How many additional teams, if any, would you put in there?
Well, ideally, from a totally idealistic standpoint, 16 would be the right number, because if there are 10 conferences, you've got the group of five and you've got the power five. If you're going to have a champion determined in the FCS, in the FBS, like they do in FCS, you've got to have representation from all the conferences who meet the eligibility requirements to be classified as FBS. Now, most people would agree that the FBS, that the group of five, probably really doesn't have much of a chance. Some could argue that maybe Central Florida does this year, but probably not as far as winning a championship. So the solution there is you create yet another classification, like they split up Division I a number of years ago into what was first 1A and 1AA, and is now FBS and FCS. Maybe you create a third classification, and those group of five teams can have their own playoff as far as determining their champion. So if you want to do that, that's fine. But if they meet the qualifications of being in major college football, they should be entitled to participate. So ideally, I would like to see 16 teams, the 10 conference champions, and then six at-large teams. That would include the teams like the Alabamas and the Ohio States or Wisconsins, the Miami of Florida, who had great seasons. Actually, I think the team that has not gotten a lot of attention but would also have been deserving of consideration is Penn State. They lost two games this year, both on the road, one by 1 point at Ohio State and the other by 3 points at Michigan State, when that game was delayed for like 3-4 hours because of weather. So that's a team that would be deserving as well. I could understand also perhaps adopting something along the lines of what the FCS does. That's the small college, the old 1AA. They have actually 24 teams invited. The teams seeded 1 through 12 get a bye the first week, while the other eight teams, seeds 17 to 24, play four games to determine the teams that will go in and fill out the field of 16. So you sort of reward the top 12 teams by making the other eight teams. That may be a little bit unwieldy, but that at least would provide a way in which you could determine a team out of the group of five to get in there. And I think the same thing would work if you wanted to do it like 10 teams or 12 teams and get it down to eight so that you have eight teams. You might have one representative from the group of five, and the other seven would be the five conference champions and two at-large teams.
So no downtime. They'd have to continue to play through the month of December.
It would occur because of the way things go. For example, even the Army-Navy game, which is this week, you could have those teams play, let's say, beginning December 15th. So you could have, let's say, December 15th, the 22nd, the 29th, and then the 5th of January. And you know, depending upon if you had more than 16 teams initially, the 12th of January. Number one, all the schools are out during December 15th to generally middle of January, so that you're not taking away from school time like they do in the NCAA tournament, which occurs during, for the most part, teams that schools that do not have school breaks, except maybe when Easter falls at a certain time of the certain calendar year. And the other thing is, you know, you have these FCS teams that I just mentioned started with 24 teams. They have no problem playing three or four extra games.
Andy Isco getting it done here with the resolution for the college now invitational, as they call it, a playoff, but not really a playoff. I'm going to go with you all the way. It is an invitational because they decide not the conference champions.
Basically, they decide what four teams. I mean, again, if you're a commissioner of the Pac-12 or the Big Ten this year, that means two major conferences are being left out. I hardly call that's like, suppose in the NFL this year, let's say you take the AFC. Well, New England's a great champion of the AFC East. Pittsburgh's a real good champion in the AFC North. You know, Jacksonville or Tennessee is a deserving champion of the AFC South. Well, you might have an 8-8 or 9-7 team win the AFC West. Let's leave them out of the playoffs.
All right, good point. Good point. Speaking of the NFL, Andy Isco, Logical Approach with us. Let's go there. We have at least 6 to 7, the 8 really good matchups starting tomorrow night. Two teams trying to keep pace with one another, as well as the Panthers, and that's the Saints at Atlanta. Give us your numbers and what you see here in this matchup.
Attractive matchup this week that have bearings for both teams in the game. No one has really clinched anything yet. The four best teams, Minnesota, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, and New England, are each 10-2. So theoretically, they could go 10-6, and that would probably be good enough to get them in the playoffs, but they haven't mathematically clinched yet. Now, as far as the Thursday night game, a very attractive matchup, in fact, one of two meetings between the Falcons and the Saints over the final 4 weeks of the season. Right now, and we've seen a lot of movement here, Atlanta opened a one-point favorite on Sunday. The movement has been to New Orleans. Initially, we're in New Orleans. I don't know that they ever reached two, but I know they've been 1.5. I'm still showing a 1.5 out there. But we're also seeing the number come back right down now to either New Orleans 1 or the game of Pick'em. And that seems to be a pretty good indicator of the difference between these two teams, which is really not very much. So if you go with the line of Pick'em, they're basically saying that on a neutral field, New Orleans is a three-point favorite, and perhaps based upon what we've seen out of them this year, you could make the case. But let's again remember that Atlanta is the defending NFC champion, and they started the season nicely. Then they went into about a 4 or 5 week spin where they started to look mediocre, and they perhaps were suffering from the Super Bowl hangover, but they've picked it up recently, had a nice little winning streak prior to last week's home loss to Minnesota. Now, that 14-9 loss to Minnesota is no embarrassment. Minnesota, they've won all those games in a row. They are 10-2. They now have the number one seed, so I don't really downgrade Atlanta all that much off of that loss. However, I am a little concerned that Atlanta really hasn't beaten a lot of elite teams this year, although you can go back and take a look at some of their efforts earlier in the season that they did perform very well in some of those games against at least second-tier teams. My preference in this game is for the Atlanta Falcons. They're going to meet New Orleans again in a couple of weeks. I think that New Orleans, Atlanta, and Carolina all have excellent chances of making the playoffs. I don't see anyone coming out of the NFC East or the NFC North making the playoffs, where Minnesota and Philadelphia pretty much have those divisions wrapped up. They're both 10-2. The other team that could sneak in as either as a wild card would be the second place team in the NFC West, where you've got the Rams having a one-game lead over Seattle, which is playing extremely well right now. They will meet, I believe it's next week or the week after, in Seattle. Seattle won the earlier game, so Seattle, which trails the Rams by a game, can actually catch the Rams with a win when they meet head-to-head, assuming both teams have the identical result this week, which would then give Seattle the NFC West. So I would say that the wild card race realistically comes down to two of the three teams in the NFC South and one of the two teams in the NFC West, with four of those five teams making it to the playoffs, along with Minnesota and Philly.
It's pretty wild. It's pretty competitive. Parity does make it exciting.
It's parity at the top.
Yeah, you're right. Especially of that AFC West. We'll get to that in a bit. But you mentioned the south of the NFC, the strongest division in football. But the one team that's kind of left out of the picture is Tampa. They play at home to Detroit. They've been a real disappointment this year. I don't know what's going on inside their locker room, but on the field, they don't display the talent that we believe they are potential of having and showing us. Detroit, on the other hand, we saw the miracles that took place last year. Not so much this year in the fourth quarter, but still competitive and still with a playoff shot.
Playoff shot somewhat remote. There's no line on this game. In fact, if you go back to the Westgate, which puts out the lines 1 week in advance of the matchups before the intervening week is played, there was no line on this game last week, but for a different reason. Last week, it was uncertain when the lines come out, I believe on Tuesday, whether or not Jameis Winston would be cleared to play after his injured shoulder or if Ryan Fitzpatrick would start, so there was no advance line. Line came out in the middle of the week when it was announced that Winston would start. Well, now there's no line because of the injury that Detroit's quarterback Matthew Stafford suffered last week, and there's still no indication as to whether or not he's going to be able to suit up and play this week. So there's no line on this game. Detroit 6-6, Tampa 4-8. Detroit on the fringe of playoff elimination. I would imagine Detroit, with or without Stafford, comes a very slight favorite. You know, maybe if without Stafford, maybe this game actually opens up, maybe close to pick. Maybe with Stafford, Detroit opens 2-2.5. I'm not quite sure on that. I've never been. That's never been an area of expertise guessing lines when there is an injury involved, but I would expect Detroit still to be the favorite team. And if Stafford starts, I think my play in this game when the total comes out would be over the total, because Tampa Bay does not have much of a defense. Decent offense. Detroit better offensively with Stafford in there. So I would imagine if there is a total in this game, it'd be in roughly the mid-40s. So I would look that way, and I would also prefer to take Detroit if Stafford plays.
You know, there's a baloney thing going on down in Jacksonville. We'll get to later with their head coach, Doug Marrone. But doing a great job his first year there. He's changed the entire culture of Jacksonville. And they're at home to Seattle. I'll take Seattle every Sunday night when they're at home. There's nothing like that atmosphere, and it's always a very entertaining game. Well, we'll see, because Seattle, it doesn't matter where the game is. When they go on the road, they could go back and forth across the country, across different timelines, and still put up good numbers with their quarterback. And Russell Wilson's really the only reason why they're right there in the playoff picture.
Yeah, if you didn't have someone named Carson Wentz and maybe to a lesser extent Case Keenum of the Vikings and even Jared Goff of the Rams, you could make a case that Russell Wilson would be the most valuable player in the league this year with what he's done for Seattle, given all the injuries at running back, the offensive line, and especially to their defense. So Russell Wilson is enjoying an outstanding season. Seattle at 8-4, I mentioned a moment ago, a game behind the Rams in the NFC West, but certainly in control of one of the two wild cards in the NFC right now. along with Carolina, excuse me, Atlanta and New Orleans are up there as well as far as the playoff positions right now. I'm sorry, New Orleans and Carolina are the ones that have the leads there in the West in the South. Atlanta 7-5, so that's why they need the win tomorrow night a little bit more than New Orleans. So Carolina and Seattle 8-4 control the two wild cards. Jacksonville finally is leaving up to the promise that living up to the promise that many people have had for them. Really, the last 2-3, maybe even 4 years ago, they were always a fashionable pick before the season to exceed their season win totals, and they never have until finally this year. They're going to have a winning season that should be enough to get them into the playoffs. The money has come in on Seattle in this game. The line opened with Jacksonville a 3-point favorite. They're down to 2.5, and I can understand it's not a play against Jacksonville, but more a play on Seattle, their experience, their late season success in recent years. I do prefer Jacksonville because of their defensive prowess. They've been outstanding all year, not only on defense, but also in the running game. Blake Bortles has his moments as quarterback, more negative than positive, but any negatives that he's had this year, that defense has been able to overcome. They've been very good this year, bouncing back off a loss as they did again last week with their solid win over a very weak Indianapolis team. Seattle has struggled a bit on the road this year. I think laying under a field goal in this game, or actually even a field goal or less, I would prefer to play the Jags. By the way, this game, originally scheduled for 10 o'clock, is now one of the featured afternoon games at 1:25.
We're going to give you two West games, and then we'll come back to the Carolina-Minnesota game, the Oakland-Kansas City game. Here we go, 6-6 at the top. You were 5-0 Kansas City. All of a sudden now, it seems like they have fallen apart in their locker room. Peters suspended their defensive back for what he did in that game against the Giants where the flag was thrown. He took the flag, threw it in the stands. He's not going to be available. And he's a very good player. The Raiders, of course, now right there at 6-6. They at one point were struggling at 2-4. And I'll combo that with the Redskins going into StubHub to play the Chargers. The Chargers, after converting their defense, transitioning from a 3-4 to a 4-3, their bookends Ingram and Bosa tearing it up right now in the sack column and also disturbing peace for opposing quarterbacks. I'll let you analyze those two matchups.
Yeah, I'll start with the Charger-Washington game. The line is a pretty solid 6. I'm showing one or two instances of 6.5s around town. Basically going with 6. Washington's not a terrible team at 5-7. They're not going to make the playoffs, but they do have a quarterback who can at least make some plays and a defense that has performed well at times. They didn't show it last week against Dallas on that Thursday night game, but a lot of that had to do with the early Washington turnovers that enabled Dallas to jump out to a 17-0 lead, and basically Washington couldn't do much to mount a comeback in that 38-14 Dallas win. The Chargers seem to play close games almost every week. Now, they did have that exception when Peterman started at quarterback for Buffalo and threw those 5 interceptions in the Chargers' 54-24 win, but they more normally than not play close games. Even last week was a 9-point game as nearly a 2-touchdown favorite against winless Cleveland, so often they struggle much more than they should. Often they pull these games out, and many times they don't. They are 6-6, and you could argue they should be better than 6-6, but they've also had a couple of wins that were nail-biters as well. I'd prefer to take the 6 points with Washington, though I do expect the Chargers to win. It's largely a function of Washington's not a bad football team. They're not a great or even a good football team, but they're not a bad football team. I'd say probably more closer to good than they are bad, but pretty average. That seems to be a lot of points for the Chargers to be laying to a team that does have a quarterback who can at least make some plays. As far as the Kansas City-Oakland game goes, I wanted to back Kansas City, and I looked at that side during the week, but I've got to pretty much pass on that one with the suspension to Peters, who is a significant contributor. Last week, the offense finally clicked. They put up 31 points on the board at the Jets, but the defense gave up 31, and the defense has been struggling all year for Kansas City. Oakland also has some issues with the defense. I do have some technical factors that point to an under in this game, but I'd be more inclined to look over the total rather than to back either side. Crabtree, the receiver, expected back for Oakland. Not quite so sure about Cooper. I'd almost count on him not being there. Kansas City, I think, still has the more talented roster going into this game. They've had injuries as well. They've missed Eric Berry since really injured, I believe, in that first game of the year at New England. But things are not going very well. I mean, they're 1-6 after that 5-0 start. Oakland has performed better since their four-game midseason losing streak. The numbers would say Oakland. My gut tells me Kansas City, so my preference is to look for both offenses to have success against two struggling defenses.
You mentioned Minnesota right there on top, and Case Keenum is a wonder. I mean, a guy was a journeyman, and here he is now starting for the Minnesota Vikings with that torrid defense and getting it done. On the other side, Cam Newton, it didn't look like early he was focused, but we're seeing now that Carolina's getting it done. Here's the situation. You're at home. This is not a must-win game, but it's almost a game that you need because you're going to be playing within the division after this. Carolina at home to Minnesota. Your thoughts?
Well, yeah. I mean, they've already lost twice to New Orleans, so they're basically three games behind, at least two games behind the Saints, even though they're just one game behind right now with the record, so they'd have to make up some games there. So Carolina's best shot at making the playoffs right now is basically through one of the wild cards. As I mentioned, they are tied with Seattle for the wild card, with Atlanta, another division rival, right behind, and I believe they still have to face one each other later over the last final 3 weeks. Minnesota at 10-2 right now actually has the tiebreaker edge over Philadelphia for the number one seed. That could change depending upon how the strength of schedule factors play out over the final few weeks. But they've all but wrapped up the NFC North with Detroit at 6-6, Green Bay at 6-6, meaning that Minnesota needs just one more win or one more loss from Detroit and Green Bay to wrap up the division title in the NFC North. So Minnesota's going to make the playoffs. Carolina realistically is competing for a wild card. And I'm looking at the line in this game, and I'm saying, well, you've got Minnesota, a 2.5-point road favorite. Well, that means on a neutral field, if you use 3 points as the standard site differential, they'd be 5.5 on a neutral field and 8.5 at home over Carolina. And Carolina's a pretty decent football team. That seems to be too many points to be laying at home. They're only laying 2.5 on the road. Now, I went last week against Atlanta as a 2.5-point home favorite, took the points with Minnesota on the road. I don't like laying points with them against a playoff-caliber football team. Now, they've won all those games in a row. I would think that streak probably ends somewhere, and if it's going to end, it's going to most likely end on the road. So that straight-up winning streak could end right here, not just with them failing to cover, but failing to win the game. Carolina has its flaws, but they do have an outstanding defender in Luke Kuechly. They do have Cam Newton, who is capable of making some big plays. If there's nothing not to like about the Minnesota defense, they showed that last week at Atlanta. These are two teams that I look to play on more often than play against. So this is not a play against Minnesota. This is a play on Carolina.
All right, we've got the last four games. I'll give them to you in pairs. Andy Esco, Logical Approach here on the show. Game on. Philadelphia and the Rams. Great matchup there. Two teams on top in their divisions, and the Rams have turned it around under their young head coach. Philadelphia with Carson Wentz getting it done on the field as well. Dallas, still a pulse for the playoffs. They play the Giants.
Yeah, looking at the Dallas Giants game first, I like the Giants in this spot. They've had problems all year, a lot of internal problems. They finally got rid of the head coach and the general manager earlier this week. Eli's going to be back at quarterback. Dallas had a nice win last week against Washington to keep them barely alive in the playoff race. Of course, again, they're still behind 7-5 Atlanta and the two 8-4 teams, Seattle and Carolina. They run the table. They finished 10-6. Philadelphia would have to lose all four games to finish 10-6, and then you go to tiebreakers after that. So Dallas realistically does not have a chance for the division title, and a pretty remote chance for making the playoffs. The Giants have said the right things. They're going to play to win these final few games. They have an opportunity to knock their division rival almost officially out of the playoffs, I believe, with a loss here. So, and if not officially, realistically out of the playoffs. The Giants do have some talent that they can rely on. They've had a decent enough running game, even though that's still a weakness. Eli's still a decent quarterback. He's gotten used to the replacement receivers that they've had after guys like Beckham and Marshall went down. This is a spot, I think, where the Giants rally around to show that the decision was right and that there indeed was some negative feelings throughout the locker room towards Ben McAdoo. So I like the Giants in this game. Would not be surprised with the outright upset. Philadelphia and the Rams, marquee game of the week as far as records go, 10-2 and 9-3. Philadelphia with a loss here would drop from the number one seed to the number three seed. But in looking at last week's game when they went to Seattle, my comments, I don't know if I made it in the show, but I mentioned on the show, but I know I wrote up but in some of the writings that I did that I felt Philadelphia in this West Coast swing at Seattle and the Rams would split the games. I felt the game they most likely would lose would be last Sunday night at Seattle. The game that they most likely would win would be at the Rams. So far, the first part of those thoughts came true with the loss at Seattle, where they actually outgained Seattle in that game, and they played a lot better than the final score would indicate, although Seattle clearly the better team in that game, and that's not a surprise. Seattle's a December team. The Rams still new to the playoff experience. They've had a fine season, and again, much like the game between Carolina and Minnesota, these are two teams I've been looking to play on most of the season. So this is not a play against the Rams. It's a play on Philadelphia. I give them the edge at quarterback with Carson Wentz having done a little bit more overall than Jared Goff has, although Goff has recovered from a poor season last year. Philadelphia's made remarkable strides defensively. I think they're nearly 100 yards per game better in games 7 through 12 than they were in games 1 through 6. When they weren't terrible defensively, they've been outstanding. In fact, for the year, against the rush, and that we're talking now about going up against Todd Gurley, the Eagles are allowing 68 yards per game, and it's been nicely balanced. 70 in their first six games, 66 yards per game in their last six games. As far as pass defense goes, they've gone from allowing something like 277 to about 177, something along those edges. So I think Philadelphia brings in the better defense, or at least the defense that has shown greater improvement. Again, these are two teams I like to play on. The Rams, in effect, I'm not going to say they can afford the loss, but they would need to win next week against Seattle. So even if Seattle were to win this week and the Rams were to lose and the teams would be tied, the Rams would still need a win next week to take a lead on Seattle, because if the Rams lose, if they go into next week's game against Seattle and they're a game down and Seattle wins a game, and they're a game ahead of Seattle and Seattle wins, the teams would be tied, but Seattle would have completed a season sweep because they won the game earlier in Los Angeles. So my preference is for Philadelphia. It's a big game for them, not quite as big for the Rams, because the Rams season may very well come down to next week against Seattle.
Andy, we got a minute left here where you and I have gone a bit long here, but the final one will be Baltimore and Pittsburgh.
Yeah, I'd like to back Baltimore in this spot, but Jimmy Smith, the cornerback, out for Baltimore. I'm going to look under the total in this game, and I would still prefer taking the points with Baltimore, because historically these teams have played games decided by 3 points. Pittsburgh has some flaws. Joe Flacco will have to be at his best. But Pittsburgh, of course, also Shazier out now. It could be another physical game. I would have liked to have taken the 7 or even the 6. The game is now to 5 in a lot of spots, but I would lean towards Baltimore.
Always a pleasure, my friend. Let the folks know where they can find you.
The Pages of Gaming Today, which comes out available at Sportsbooks on Tuesdays, where I do give previews of each NFL game and also an NBA column. My website, thelogicalapproach.com, where I've got all the statistical matchups for this week's NFL schedule, Army-Navy, all the bowl games, and daily in the NBA.
Always a pleasure. Happy holidays to you, Andy.
Happy holidays. Have a great weekend, Steve.
You got it. Andy Esco, the human handicapping machine. He gets it done. All right, we went a bit long, so we're going to step away. Lighters up. Dope is next.
Same for a special occasion.
Look like a quarter pounder, man. Led Zeppelin.
Man, be careful with that, man.
Is it heavy stuff, man? Will it blow me away?
It's time now for Man, That Show Is Dope.
3:44 in the valley. Lighters up. Pass it. Got to talk some football here. You hungry?
Always.
You and I were talking about this before the show. Is it pronounced baloney or bologna?
Oh, you were talking to TC about that because I know it's pronounced.
But you
Bologna.
Were there, okay?
Bologna. But the country is Bologna, is what he's saying.
Yeah, but I heard ESPN announcer call it Bologna. I've never eaten Bologna. I've eaten bologna before.
There you go.
But Doug Marrone, the head coach of Jacksonville, he has changed their culture. I told you many a years going into their locker room after losing to the Chargers on 3 years in a row that they didn't have a pulse. In their locker room, there was no pulse. I mean, they just seems like they didn't care. They got a paycheck and went home. Not the case anymore. The defense is getting it done. Now, what he does, he's about, maybe 350 pounds. He's a pretty big man. But he eats bologna, a bologna and cheese sandwich, after every Jaguar victory. Well, this bologna company got wind of it. Give a listen.
I think it's, I'd like to thank Eric, obviously for sending that down. I think, it's going to obviously go for a good cause. I think, the right thing to do is, to help, the local food shelters in the area, things of that nature. I don't know if when they looked at it, they said, well, let's send them down the bologna to match his weight. And then I'd be offended to that, about 350. But, but again, I think it's a great gesture and it's just the truth. And I think it's something that we can help, with our community and move on from there. I'm trying to. I really don't like taking. I'm not a good gift taker. You know what I'm saying? I'm just, normally, I'm just not that way. But this is, I'd probably eat more bologna than anybody else in the world, though. I will say that.
That's
my age.
Dope. So. That is pretty dope. He says, a person my age, okay, when you get up there, you kind of cut back on the red meat and the swine. The National Hot Dog and Sausage Council decided to ship 350 pounds of boar's head bologna to the Jaguars when they saw the story about Marrone's love of bologna. We win. I eat bologna. I eat bologna and cheese. I love it. My favorite meat. Not so much in my world anymore. As a kid, anything I could get, right? But bologna, if it's your lick and you're getting it, and then you get a bunch of it from a company, he's doing the right thing. He's donating it to the people that need food in that area back in Jacksonville. I think that's a real nice move. But I think it's also cool that he has this superstition. We win. I got to have a bologna and cheese sandwich. Got to have it now. I think that's pretty damn dope.
Interesting. I just want to know, how much is this guy worth? Do you know? I couldn't be eating bologna. I'm guessing he's doing all right for himself.
I got you.
Superstition or not, can you like switch it over to something that's a little healthier?
Nah, dude, you can't do
bologna,
that to me.
Though.
That's him.
I guess so.
Some people like bologna, some people like salami, some people like hot dogs, and some people like burgers.
I like plenty of stuff that's unhealthy. I guess I'm just saying, I would, a lot of the times I'm like, here's something for $3, here's something for $10. $10 way more healthy, but I'm going to go with three because, so I'm just saying, that point in my life.
If you were starving, could you eat a thick piece of bologna with cheese and nothing on the bread?
Literally starving, I have no choice. Sure, like, I'll do whatever to eat, but I'm just
the thought of it makes you want to just
yeah, pretty much
reverse.
No, not a big fan. This is another food one, actually. In August, James Yasko, an AP history teacher at Waco High School, promised his students that if the struggling Astros at this point won the World Series, he'd buy the whole class the pizza, basically a pizza party for the whole class. And the students just rolled their eyes because at that time I think the Astros were 11-17 just in that month. They're on a 5-game losing streak as he brought this up, and also where they are, it's like Ranger County, all Texas Rangers,
right.
So that's the rival, and so obviously, as Astros went ahead, won the World Series. So Yasko kept his word. He ordered $54 worth of Little Caesars pizzas. I forget the amount of pizzas, several pizzas. And he tweeted it out, told my AP U.S. History students, I'd buy them pizza if the Astros won the World Series, with a pick of the pizzas. So that'll be $54, guys. He was just joking. Less than an hour later, he got a reply from infielder Tyler White, got Venmo. And Venmo is, if you're not familiar, it's like PayPal. It's a pay thing you can pay over online. Less than an And then White then quickly sent $60 to the account. So he actually paid for the pizza party, even though the teacher was kidding. I thought that was pretty dope.
It is dope. Yeah. I'll admit that is dope. We salute our heroes, and firemen are heroes and policemen are heroes. And you hope that you get good firemen, guys that will go in. That's their automatic instinct when we're running out. And you hope you get good policemen who protect us. I couldn't be a cop. I'll admit, there's no way. There's too many temptations. And then to go and try to save somebody who's a criminal against another criminal, or a gangbanger against another gangbanger. I'm running like everybody else. I'm sorry. Gun down, I'm gone. So this gentleman who's a police officer back in New York, he's a cop for 35 years. This has gone viral. He retires in his car. He's on talking with his speaker in his car, excuse me, his microphone in his car, and he's basically signing off, and the dispatcher signs him off as he retires. It's pretty cool. Check it out.
This is Theo Robert W. Brown, show number 1120. This will be my final signal, too. It's been a great ride with a great bunch of men and women, and I thank you all. Please continue to watch over Westchester, and above all, be safe and come home to your loved ones at the end of your tour. Headquarters, take me out of service.
After 35 years of faithful and dedicated service to the Westchester County Police Department, Police Officer Robert W. Brown, Shield 1120, is Signal 2 for the final time. Please join me in wishing Theo Brown a happy, healthy, and safe retirement. You'll be missed, my friend. Congratulations. You're out of service at 2229.
That's a pretty cool moment. He videotaped it, so for his family, his grandchildren, if he has any or any other loved ones, that right there is forever. You know, when you have something on video or audio, especially if you can visually see it, for your family members down the road. I mean, when you talk about Papa or Great Papa, you have this video. So that gentleman for 35 years, the way he went out, dropped the mic, dog.
Yeah.
Dope.
Dropped the walkie. Yeah. 35 years in anything is really, I can respect that, but especially to
except for a marriage.
Keep going.
Well, hey.
Wow.
Way. Whoa.
Anyway, salute to that officer. Because that was pretty dope.
You got one more for us here for the giveaway?
Yeah, I got one for that giveaway. All right. This is funny. This is from March, but I just double checked to see in the latest articles in October. So a Mexican chef named Juan Lucerio. I'm going to say that's how you say his name.
Pronunciation.
Thank you. He's in Cabo San Lucas. He works at a resort called, an exclusive resort called Gran Veles Los Cabos Resort. He's a chef. So he made a $25,000 taco. Kobe
what?
Beef. Yeah. Kobe beef, lobster, beluga, caviar, black truffle brie cheese stuffed in a gold-infused tortilla. Can't make this up if I wanted to. And the truffle brie cost $100 an ounce. The beluga caviar, $700 an ounce. We're talking, this is like more expensive than,
So how big
cocaine.
Is this thing?
Or it's cocaine. They didn't even say. The takeaway here, I mean, it's kind of dope, but it's also kind of silly, is in October now, I still have yet to. No, they can't confirm anyone's actually purchased it. No one wants it. It's $25,000.
Well, it's been sitting in the freezer for
that too.
2 months
I mean,
now.
I'm sure they make it fresh, but. And here's some funny caveats to the situation, too. You must be staying in the presidential suite already to even be eligible to purchase this taco for $25,000. You must put down half the $12,500 deposit.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, so you can't have any second thoughts.
So you can't do a layaway on it. It is a layaway.
It's exactly
you gotta
what it is.
You got to put $25,000 on it.
And then they recommend you pair it with Tequila Ley 925, which is a white gold bottle worth $150,000. So, you know, if you got $175,000 lying around and could think of anything in the world better, doper than getting the taco.
I think this guy is a dope.
Yeah,
he's not going to sell that.
At first, I'm like, well, hey, you know, whatever. I was indifferent. And then when I realized they haven't even sold one, I mean, what were you thinking?
Take it off the menu.
You're a dope.
Yep. All right. Lighters down, by the way. Let's do the giveaway right here. We're going to close the show out. I want to say thanks to Andy Hisco, Logical Approach. Also to Ari. We'll take caller number 702-365-9200, 702-365-9200. You've got the Rebel tickets December 20th against Mississippi Valley State. Seed Williams, peace and out.